Well, we're in the midst of two close Wisconsin races for the big ticket items in next month's election, a U.S. Senate seat and the race for president. My guest this hour has some of the latest poll numbers and some ideas about what's making a difference for voters. Good morning. I'm Rob Verrett, filling in for Joy Cardine. It's 7 minutes after 6 o'clock on Thursday, October 18th. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is Charles Franklin. He's a visiting professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com, and he joins me here in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Well, let's look at the big results. What's the presidential race looking like in Wisconsin right now?
Well, we've seen a dramatic tightening of the race since the first presidential debate just over 2 weeks ago now. What had been a high single-digit lead for President Obama has shrunk to a dead heat, nearly an exact tie, with Obama at 49%, Romney at 48%, though they're not actually a full percentage point apart. They're really tenths of a percentage point apart.
Doesn't get much closer than that.
Not very much.
And we'll focus in on that a little more, but first, the Senate race, Tammy Baldwin, Tommy Thompson. What are your main numbers in that?
There, the race has been tightening for a while, but if anything, it's slightly tighter than the presidential race, 45-46, and also a matter of the decimal points. It's tenths of a point apart in that race, too. Now, that one was about a four-point Baldwin lead 2 weeks ago in our previous poll, and so that race has tightened from a slim Baldwin lead to, again, an absolute tie.
We'll dig into those numbers a little deeper, but first, Wisconsin's a purple state.
You know, we've oscillated a little bit about that with periods where Obama had a significant lead. In the Senate race, we've had periods when Thompson had a significant lead, 9 points, to be followed by points where Baldwin had a 9-point lead. And now we've seen tightening in that race. But at the moment, we sure look back to our usual purple rather than tending one color or the other.
And is it a case where we've got a bunch of people who are always going to vote Democrats over here, a bunch of people who are always going to vote Republican over here, and a little wiggle room in the middle of undecideds?
Yeah, except the wiggle room's a little bigger than we often think of it as being. Over the course of our year-long polling, we've now passed 10,000 people we've interviewed over the year. 32% call themselves Democrats, 30% on average call themselves Republican, and that leaves about 37% who call themselves independents. And among those 37% independents, at least 15% and maybe more are people who often are mixing their votes. So in the recall period, we saw them supporting Governor Walker, but at the same time supporting President Obama. We see them in these last 2 months of polling that we've done shifting pretty substantially, especially in the Senate race and the presidential race. In the month of September, which was a good period for Democrats, moving pretty solidly in a Democratic direction. But in the last 2 weeks, again, following that first presidential debate, swinging back pretty sharply the other. Now, we finished our interviews Sunday night, mm-hmm. so none of our interviews speak in any way to the second presidential debate.
Now, is Wisconsin weird in this way, or do we reflect what's going on in the rest of the country as far as our partisan makeup?
Yeah, you know, states vary, of course, sure. in the degree of partisanship. I think that we probably, in general, underestimate how many persuadable voters there are. And persuadable in the sense that these are voters who may prefer a candidate, but under the right circumstances, with the right kind of new information or new actions by the candidates, can be persuaded to go over and vote for the other side. Now, of course, we have a lot of committed and dedicated partisans on both sides, and not in the negative sense of partisanship, but in the sense that their values and their issue preferences align with their party, and they see a big difference between the two parties. And those groups together probably make up about 60, maybe as much as 75% of the electorate. And then there are maybe 25% or so that's left, who lean to one party or the other, but can be persuaded under the right circumstances, in that we may be a little more persuadable than some other parts of the country. It certainly means that our elections can be a little more dynamic because of that.
Rob Verrett talking to political scientist Charles Franklin about his newest Marquette Law School survey numbers on the presidential race. In a bit, we'll talk more about the Senate race. Interested to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. Your thoughts on the presidential race? Did the debates switch your vote or the vote of someone you know? Do you think they're important? Are you somebody who would vote for Darth Vader if he took the right partisan label into the next election? Or do you consider yourself persuadable? Have you gone back and forth over the years? 800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about debates a little bit, Charles Franklin. Coming into the first debate, a lot of talk from both sides about what a good debater the other side was to lower expectations. And I think a sense in a lot of the analysis I saw that debates, unless somebody really just punts it, don't make that big a difference in the poll. And well,
yeah.
How did that turn out?
Well, some would say that someone really punted the ball on that. One of the things that's true about most debates is that we see small pluralities believing one side won compared to the other. So you get something that's 45% for one side and 35% for the other. What was unusual about the first presidential debate was that large majorities saw Romney as having performed better, and that was true among Democrats as well. And indeed, a lot of Democrats were very critical and pejoratively were panicked about it. Andrew Sullivan was famously pointed to as an example of an Obama supporter who was very vociferous in his concerns about it. So that first debate was not primarily one where the two sides could each see their guys doing better, but it was decidedly one-sided. That's the recipe for when we see some big effects. And we've certainly seen them in national polling, in other state polling. We've seen states where Obama had held a pretty steady lead, though not necessarily a large one, for a couple of months. And we've seen those states like Virginia, like Florida, show some real movement over these past 2 weeks. Now, of course, after the second debate, we'll see what's happening as we go forward.
And you dug a little deeper into the impact of the debate in your survey that you released yesterday. What did you find?
That's where we see some I think, really significant movement. And it's primarily in the image of Governor Romney rather than in the image of President Obama. In one sense, you might expect that. An incumbent president, people have pretty well-formed views. But Governor Romney's been running for president for a while now. He's been in the news a lot in the last year, as you may have noticed. And so the ability of that debate to move some numbers for him, I thought, was interesting. For example, one of the complaints that Democrats have made, but others as well, is that Governor Romney's not been specific about what he would do in policy. Before the debate, we found just 28% in Wisconsin said that Romney had been specific enough about his policies. 69% said he had not. After the debate, in our newest poll, 37% say specific enough, 60% say not enough. So that's it hasn't flipped it, but it's a 9-point move in both directions. Whereas for President Obama, it started out at 46-51 and moved to 48-49. So relatively little movement there. But one of the areas where Romney has struggled politically this year is in the sense of empathy. So one of our questions was, how well does the phrase cares about people like you describe Mitt Romney, Barack Obama? Before the debate, 39% said Romney cares about people like you. 56% say he does not. After the debate, it moved to 47-49. And so that's a pretty substantial movement that makes Romney a stronger candidate and reflects how people started to rethink about him after that debate.
I thought that was interesting looking at your numbers. It's not even so much just that there's a perception that Mitt Romney won that first debate, but that a lot of the question marks in people's minds were answered by his performance in that debate. To the extent you can judge that from your numbers, is that right?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. One is people saw him as more empathetic, more caring. I think, you know, if you look at how he especially started that first debate, he was at pains to talk about how he was in a position to care about people. The unemployed woman that comes to him and says, you know, my husband just lost his job. What can you do to help us? And so I thought those stories and other things that he said emphasized that part. He also emphasized that he cared about 100% of the population, another area that he's had some trouble with. And so that did move some numbers. On the other hand, the specificity, even though, as I say, it moved in his direction, still more people would like to hear more details about his plans.
Rob Verrett filling in for Joy Cardine, talking to Charles Franklin about the new Marquette Law School survey numbers, the race for president, and the race for the U.S. Senate seat in Wisconsin. Looking at the weather, today cloudy and cool, scattered showers, highs from 48 to 52. Tonight cloudy with a chance of showers, lows 38 to 42. Tomorrow cloudy and cool, chance of showers, highs 48 to 52, lows 38 to 48. Sunny and milder on the weekend. Rob Verrett filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Verrett filling in for Joy Cardine here at the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests take a look at the art world, a new exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum. That's coming up after 9. This hour, talking to Charles Franklin about his new Marquette Law School survey numbers. You can join the conversation talking about the presidential race right now at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts about the impact of the presidential debates on the poll numbers, other things that might sway you as an undecided voter or you think might sway other voters. Before we get to the phones at 800-642-1234, Charles Franklin, a couple other numbers we wanted to key in on. Debate viewers versus non-debate viewers. How did that play out?
Yeah, we asked people if they had watched that first presidential debate. And among those who had watched, Mitt Romney had moved to a 50-48 advantage, a two-point advantage. But among people who said they had not watched the debate, Obama continued to lead 50-42. So in that net 10-point gap between the two is where almost all of the closing of our poll has been. We had an 11-point Obama lead 2 weeks ago before the debate. It's now become this less than 1-point lead. Almost all of that can be seen in this difference between debate watchers and non-debate watchers.
And one of the things I think people are watching for in a debate is this candidate fit to lead the country? Is this a leader I'm looking at? Is that something you delved into in the poll?
We did. And, of course, part of debates, including the first, but especially the second one this week, showed how the two candidates interact with each other and sort of showing who can take control. So we asked as well about which candidate is a strong leader. Does the phrase strong leader describe each of these? Again, Obama's image hardly changed, but Romney went from 47% strong, 44 not strong, to 55 strong, 37 not strong. So again, you see the piece here that Obama was little changed by that debate, but where we can measure changes, they've almost all moved in Romney's direction.
We'll go to the phones now with your calls for Charles Franklin at 800-642-1234. And Joe will start us off in Milwaukee. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. I am one of those 70%, or I should say the non-70%, the 30% of the people who have flipped both ways over the years. I'm in my 60s. I have voted Democratic and Republican at various times based on issues and leadership, perception of leadership skills from Reagan to the first George Bush, Bill Clinton. And I'm presently favoring President Obama on the theory that I don't know who Mitt Romney really is. I've follow him very closely, but I don't know who he really is. If he is really in carrying the mantle under wraps of the neocons, and you worry about that with the Koch brothers and other people like that, the industrialists who, the neocons who got us into the wars that have cost us and put a huge deficit on our country, if he is in their clutches and just not telling us about it, I'm concerned.
Well, is there something that Mitt Romney could say or do that would allay those fears and get your vote?
No. No. No, there's not. I'm afraid that I'm going to have to take the devil that I know versus the devil that I don't know.
Gotcha. Well, thanks for calling in, Joe. Not undecided voter, it sounds like, but voicing some of the concerns, I think, that are out there probably from both sides.
Perhaps a persuadable who now feels he's been persuaded.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, I think in some sense this is both the strength and the weakness of a challenger. When you have an incumbent, that incumbent, by definition, has a very specific record over the previous 4 years. And so for better or worse, that record is going to be attached to the incumbent. For a challenger, sometimes that record is so bad that the challenger can build a case fairly easily. And those are the times that we see incumbent presidents easily defeated. Other times, the situation is so positive that we see runaway reelection campaigns, landslides, and the best challenger in the world can't overcome that. Where we seem to be this year is a much more mixed picture, with both sides seeing some strong points, but also some weaknesses. And that question of credibility, of how do I know what the challenger will do, is one that challengers historically have to overcome in some way.
Well, it's interesting because one of Mitt Romney's lines of attack this week is President Obama hasn't laid out his vision for a second term, trying to raise some of those same question marks that are out there about a challenger to an incumbent.
I think that's right. And in our data, we saw that a significant fraction of the public, nearly half, also agreed that Obama had not been clear enough about his plans for a second term. And this is something that columnists and Democratic writers have also pointed out, that what is the plan for the second term? But with an incumbent, you have that past record. You think about things like the budget and the question of Mitt Romney and his tax plan. What would Romney do with his tax plan? There's nothing like being president where you actually have to submit a budget where you have to lay that out in detail. Challengers never have to, and they often benefit from it because some ambiguity allows you not to face the most difficult challenges.
Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine, talking to political scientist Charles Franklin about right now the race for president. We're going to get into Wisconsin's U.S. Senate seat a little more deeply in the second half of this hour. We'll take your calls at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can play pundit today and say where you see the race going and what the big difference makers are. Call and tell us if you were swayed by the debate, or the first one or the second one, or the vice presidential debate, which I'll ask about. Join the show at 800-642-1234. Email talk at WPR.org, and you can always post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Charles Franklin, I just mentioned the vice presidential debate. It was lively. It was maybe a little more attended to than the average running mate debate. Did you look at that in your survey?
We did, and it was well-timed from our point of view because some of our interviews, more than a third, were done before the debate and the rest done after. So we have a nice before and after picture. On the overall scorecard picture of those who watched the debate, Representative Ryan did a little bit better. 51% say he did the better job. 42% said Biden did. But there was also the question of how did their performances in those debates affect people's views of them. With Biden, before the debate, 49% said they had a favorable view of him, 41 unfavorable. But after the debate, that sunk a bit to 44 favorable, 47 unfavorable. So moving from net positive to a little net negative. Ryan, on the other hand, seems to have helped himself, 46 to 41 before the debate, 50 to 40 after the debate. So to the extent that their performances helped or hurt them, Ryan did a little bit better.
In a debate and many other aspects of her presidential campaign, the candidates are trying to balance two things, reaching out to those independent voters, but also rallying the faithful, building up that enthusiasm, making sure they're excited enough, hopefully to go knocking on doors, donating money, but ultimately, of course, to get out and vote. How have they balanced that in the debates?
Well, they've had some difficulty doing that because the purposes are rather at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing well over 90% of partisans voting with their party. In this latest poll, it's 96% of Democrats and 97% of Republicans voting with their party. So you've already got the base. The thing for them is to get them out to the polls. That's the voter contact. That's the get out the vote, the so-called ground game. The independents are more fickle. Those persuadable voters we've been talking about, if you don't know anything more about them, you might only win 60% of their vote or 55% of their vote. So they're much harder for a campaign to target.
And that's a contrast for Democrats between presidential debate number one and then the vice presidential debate. The second debate, a sense from Democrats that President Obama underperformed. And is that, I know that's hard to gauge, but does that enthusiasm really keep those guaranteed Democratic voters away from the polls?
Right. I think we can exaggerate the effects of these things, mm-hmm. and I think it's probably important to say, with now a second debate done, a third one coming up next week, and then still 2 more weeks till the election, it's important to recognize that these debates structure the short-term effects and the changes in the campaign, but it's up to the campaigns and the candidates to extend the advantages they gain in the debates and weave a longer story that carries them through to Election Day.
It's Charles Franklin, political scientist, a visiting professor at Marquette University, talking about his newest Marquette University Law School survey just released yesterday, looking at the presidential race numbers, and we'll look more at the Senate in the next hour. We'll take your calls about either race, by the way, at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can email talk at WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. A lot more to come. Tommy versus Tammy. We'll spend more time on that in the next half hour. Thanks for listening along. I'm Rob Ferret, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking to Professor Charles Franklin, he's a visiting professor at Marquette University, talking about his new Marquette Law School survey, looking at mainly the presidential race and the race for the U.S. Senate, both of them very close races in Wisconsin. We'll get to the U.S. Senate race in just a moment, but let's take some of your calls. Chaz in Oneida is with us. Hi, Chaz.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Oh, fine. Thank you very much. I was just wondering if your guest could comment to the impact of third-party politics. I know we've come to a two-party system that we've kind of accepted, but third-party politics going back to the Gore-Bush election was certainly had an impact, many say. I was wondering if you could comment to that whole issue of third-party on issues as much as the actual impact on the election with a vote.
Sure. Happy to. Third parties are disadvantaged by the kind of electoral system we have in this country, where it's called a single-member district system. If you're running for Congress, you can get elected with 25% of the vote, but only if three or four other people split the vote enough that 25's the plurality, the largest number of votes. So it means that if you're a third party that's consistently finishing in third place, it's very hard for people who have ambitions to political careers to stake their entire career on a party that will routinely finish in third place. In contrast, if you have a proportional representation system of the sort that the Netherlands and Israel and many other countries have, then a party can gain representation in the legislature, the parliament, roughly in proportion to the vote that they get. So if you're a third party there, but you could get 8% of the vote, you can count on getting something pretty close to 8% of the seats. So that's a system that encourages third parties and in some cases nurtures them so that even small minorities can gain representation. With single-member district systems like we have, it's been rare to see third parties survive for long periods of time. Where we do see it happen is mostly in regional parties, where a party that's a third party nationally might still be strong in a region. Think of the Parti Québécois in Quebec, Canada, as an example of that. The influence third parties have had historically in American elections often comes in persuading the dominant parties to shift their positions. Mm-hmm. Think of the progressive movement in the United States here in Wisconsin, and the role that had in moving the other parties to respond. Or think now of the Tea Party influence on the Republican Party and how that has shifted the party in just the last couple of years. So those are the ways that third parties usually have their influence. Even when third parties have done well, like Ross Perot in 1992, getting 19% of the national vote, he helped affect the issue agenda, even though he didn't win a single electoral vote. Or in 2000, Ralph Nader with the set of issues he was talking about, but also Buchanan in Florida had an effect on that race, but there you have the combination of incredibly close race plus third parties.
Well, and there's the concern from the two major parties that the third party closest to them might be a spoiler in the race. I know right now people are watching Virginia. I think the Constitution Party candidate, Virgil Good, who was on our network in the afternoon earlier this week, concerned that he, in a very close state race, he could pull just enough votes from Republicans to flip it to Obama.
That's right. And when you have that kind of competition for a type of voter or people within a party, that's exactly why the bigger party often responds to that, to reduce the chance that that vote is siphoned off or deflected. But there's a real chicken and an egg problem here that third parties get on ballots very regularly, but here in Wisconsin, rarely reach even 1% of the vote. And so the difficulty for third parties is how do you gain influence and gain support when you're faced with these disadvantages, structural disadvantages.
Coming up in our next hour, we'll talk to Wisconsin's Libertarian candidate for the U.S. Senate, by the way. So we'll continue the third party theme then. Right now, talking to Charles Franklin about his latest survey numbers in the races for president and U.S. Senate here in Wisconsin. Back to the phones. John in Richland Center is with us. Hi, John.
Hi. I would like to make two comments. I think that Mitt Romney is sanctimonious, which is hypocritically devout, and I think that Mr. Obama is forthright. He goes straight to the point without hesitation or ambiguity.
Let me ask you, did you go into the debates favoring President Obama and not Governor Romney?
I've always been favoring Mr. Obama.
And thank you for calling in. I appreciate that. Charles Franklin, for a lot of the partisan voters, do debates meet their expectations no matter what?
Well, often, for one thing, if you think about our values as we come into a debate, if you're a strong liberal and you see Mitt Romney talking about conservative themes, that reinforces your perception that he's too conservative. I don't like him. The opposite happens for conservatives looking at Obama, say. But these personality traits, whether Romney is sanctimonious or Obama's forthright, and other kinds of personality traits are partly in the candidate and their behavior, but they're also partly in us and the things that we see and how someone strikes us. You know, I think we've all had the experience of meeting someone new, maybe a job applicant or a friend of a friend, and do that and then talk to your spouse afterwards and find out that the two of you came away with quite different perceptions of that person. So this is an area where it's partly in the candidate, but it's also partly in how we react to people.
We'll talk about a related topic after 8 this morning, the power of our expectations in framing how we perceive reality. And we'll actually ask about debates in that hour. So don't go away. We'll keep following these things up. Back to the phones with Dave in Taylor County. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I'm just really curious after watching these debates. I was brought up, and I think a lot of people were, to think that interrupting and being overly aggressive and stepping on other people's work, taking too much time, I have time limits, that that's bad behavior. And now I keep hearing people laud that as leadership. And it really puzzles me as to why there isn't some criticism of somebody who behaves that way, you know, interrupting somebody all the time. That's, I think, generally accepted as bad. And now we call that leadership. And I'm really confused about that.
I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in and interrupt you because we're coming up on a break in a couple of minutes. Hope that isn't too bad a behavior. But Dave brings up a really big theme. Joe Biden, Mitt Romney accused of interrupting, bullying, or lauded for a bold performance.
And Obama criticized by Democrats for being too passive in the first debate. So it's sort of hard to win on this one, I think. You know, this is so much of an issue of how we perceive their behavior, courteous or not courteous, which we tend to value. But on the other hand, strong leadership in the sense of, do you just passively sit back and let the other person take control? So you see that played out here. I will say one thing for this year's debate format. For decades, literally decades, we've complained about debates being not real debates, but just joint press conferences where the two candidates stand behind the lectern. They have 60 seconds to answer questions. They take turns. There's a light that comes on that tells them when they have to stop talking. Like it or hate it, these two debates so far really have had the candidates speaking to each other. And so we've now seen 3 hours when they're basically on their own to make their case and behave well or behave poorly, be forceful or not. So I think this is an interesting change this year.
Well, and Dave's question makes me think, you know, as somebody in the media, and maybe you have this in political science as well, I think I have this ill-formed impression that all the voters out there are looking at the candidates and weighing the issues carefully and analytically, but some people are out there shooting with their gut, and this guy seems really rude. I'm not going to vote for somebody rude like that. Sure. Is that out there?
It's certainly part of it, how we perceive candidates as people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is often captured in the, but would you want to go have a beer with this guy or want to go fishing with him? So those kinds of notions are real. They're part of the person. But it also reflects that a lot of us only casually pay attention to politics. Think of a sport that you don't follow closely, and you're just sort of casually aware of that. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're irrational in a certain sense. It simply means that our attention is elsewhere. This is especially true of younger voters who typically are much harder to get to the polls and are often more undecided or more persuadable because what are you doing? You're starting a family. You're starting a career. You're finishing your education. Maybe you're even going out on weekends and having a good time, things that us old folks don't do so much anymore. So those are things that compete for our attention with politics and make it easy to come to judge people for candidates on things we see in a debate, short things rather than long, detailed policy positions.
Political scientist and pollster Charles Franklin, I've been promising that we'd spend some time on the Senate race. We will do that after we take a look at the weather. Today, cloudy and cool, scattered showers, highs 48 to 52. Tonight, cloudy with a chance of showers, lows 38 to 42 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy and cool, a chance of showers, highs 48 to 52, lows 38 to 48. Saturday, sunny, milder, highs in the mid to upper 50s. Rob Ferret here, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming after seven, Joseph Kexel. He's the Libertarian candidate for Wisconsin's U.S. Senate seat. Right now, talking to Charles Franklin about his latest Marquette University Law School survey numbers, and we're turning now to the race for that Senate seat. Tammy Baldwin, Tommy Thompson running very close. The gap has closed. Basically a tie, right, Charles Franklin?
Yeah, let me just illustrate that. So a 4-point lead for Baldwin 2 weeks ago, now a tie, though with rounding it's 46 for Thompson, 45 for Baldwin. But to give you an idea, out of 870 likely voters, the difference between the two is 3 respondents.
Not
three
percent.
People, not percent, 3 people in our survey. So that's why I keep saying it's less than 1%.
And what's going on behind those overall numbers?
I think there are two things. One important point is the nature of the Senate campaign. A recent study that came out a week ago showed that 92% of the ads in the Senate race have been negative ads, ads that criticize an opponent. And that has taken a toll in the images of both Representative Baldwin and former Governor Thompson. In our data 2 weeks ago, Thompson was 38 favorable, 49 unfavorable, upside down for a former popular four-term governor. After 2 weeks, where negative ads have been run against him for the last 2 months, that's unchanged, 37 favorable, 50 unfavorable. But for Baldwin, you're beginning to see the negative ads taking a toll. Remember that when Thompson won the primary with just 34% of the vote, he said his campaign was broke and he spent a month trying to refill the campaign coffers. And so the negative ads against Baldwin have come rather later than they have with Thompson. As a result, 2 weeks ago, Baldwin was at a near at a tie, 40% favorable, 40 unfavorable. But after two more weeks of these very negative ad campaigns from both Thompson and other groups supporting him, her favorability has fallen to 32 favorable, 47 unfavorable. So what we have is the situation, which is typical of campaigns that are dominated by negative ads, is both candidates' images have suffered from the onslaught that they've had to endure.
Talking about the U.S. Senate race with Charles Franklin, I'm Rob Farid, and for Joy Cardine, you can join in with your thoughts in the next 10 minutes or so, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What are you watching for in that Senate race? Are you watching the Senate race? Let's dig a little deeper into those negative ads. You looked, I think, at what the ads were saying and seeing if those themes or memes were catching on with the voters you surveyed.
Exactly. There have been two very consistent themes in the negative ads. Against Baldwin, the theme has been she's an extreme liberal and she's too liberal for Wisconsin. In the ads against Thompson, it's that since he left government, he has sold out to special interests and he's not for you anymore. So we asked voters whether they thought those themes described the candidates or not. Again, in Thompson's case, where those negative ads have now been running for two full months, 49% agreed 2 weeks ago that he is not working for you anymore, thus accepting the theme. 42% disagree, so slightly more agree than disagree with that theme. That's been unchanged by an additional 2 weeks of essentially the same ad campaign against him, 48 agree, 41 disagree. But with Baldwin, where that campaign is newer and wasn't out there for a full month, we see that still changing. 2 weeks ago, 45-45 split on whether people agreed that she was too liberal. But now, 2 weeks later, 48-41 agree that she's too liberal. So we're in this interesting position where 48-41 accept the negative themes about each of the candidates. So both have been victims of the other side's negative campaigns. And the same proportions of voters at this point are accepting both of those themes.
So there's always, I think, a question. We see all these political ads. Do they make a difference? Well, here's some evidence that they do.
I think in the Senate race, you really have that evidence quite strongly because we had a period in mid-August when Thompson just won the primary. He led Baldwin by 9 points. We then had a month in which the airwaves were dominated by Baldwin and outside groups supporting her in ads that were almost all about Tommy Thompson and painting him in a bad light, while the Thompson campaign was not responding much at all to that. And we saw the numbers move dramatically from a 9-point Thompson advantage to a 9-point Baldwin advantage. We've seen, I believe it's now up to 13 polls that showed Baldwin leading in that period after that month of negative ads. And now, just in our poll, we see that tightening to a tie. Other polls show Baldwin up by from 1 to 4 points, but a very competitive race. And most importantly, we see voters reflecting those themes of the advertising that they were not reflecting as strongly earlier in the year.
Anything else strike you about the numbers you got in the U.S. Senate race survey?
The one thing that may or may not be part of this advertising theme is that same question of empathy that we talked about Romney earlier. Which of the Senate candidates cares about people like you? And there, Governor Thompson is suffering on that. 42% say he cares, 49% say he does not. Whereas for Baldwin, it's 47% cares, 40% do not. Now, those numbers haven't moved over the last 2 weeks, and yet you can see ways in which they're related to the ad campaign. This will be an interesting element of the next 3 weeks, and for that matter, the debate tonight and the upcoming debate between the Senate candidates. How do they portray themselves, and how do the moderators get them to talk to each other into these issues?
I'm not a political strategist, and with good reason, but is there a place for positive ads? Could it be that if one candidate really saturated the airwaves, you know, candidate X, they care for you, does that sort of thing make an uptick, or is it a better investment to go negative?
Well, I think on the one hand, you have to look at what the behavior of the campaign professionals has been historically, and there's a strong preference for negative ads. There is a lot of talk this year that negative ads have so saturated the airways, not just here in Wisconsin, that voters are tuning them out, and that therefore what's called the closing statement, the final positive ads that are run late in a campaign, may come into play a little bit earlier as a way of cutting through the negative clutter. We've seen that with the Romney campaign running some ads in which Romney speaks directly to the camera. There was a Baldwin ad recently released that I'm not sure how widely broadcast it is, but is taking up a more positive theme. And the Thompson campaign also has some positive ads that you can see on their website, at least. So I think here in the last days, we'll probably see some shift to it. But does it happen in the last week or the last 2 weeks or sooner?
You mentioned a couple minutes ago the Senate debates. We've had one debate already between Tammy Baldwin and Tommy Thompson, another one, of course, tonight. The presidential debate made a difference. Did you see a difference from the first Senate debate?
We did not. We actually did ask about that debate. But one thing we found was, of course, not too surprisingly, a much smaller audience for a Senate debate, especially on a Friday night, compared to a presidential debate. So one part of this is how much of the audience tunes in. But it's also, of course, as I think we've also seen in the presidential debates, partly a matter of the moderators and how do the moderators get the candidates talking, as well as the candidate behavior themselves. How do they answer? How do they interact with each other? I don't know much about the format of tonight's debate, but that issue of format then becomes part of how the candidates present themselves. And finally, is there really a clear difference between them in the way voters react? We said earlier Obama was seen as the overwhelming loser of the first presidential debate. The polls show him to be the winner of the second debate, but by a smaller margin. What impact does that have here in the Senate? Same story. Do we see roughly equality, or do we see one side being more effective?
Just a minute or so left. You've been tracking these numbers for a long time. When's your next survey hitting the field?
Two more weeks. We'll have one out on the 31st.
Okay, and that'll be, I assume, the last one before Election Day.
Last Wednesday before Election Day, yes.
Okay, anything in particular you're going to be really keying in on your next survey?
I think the candidate images and how are they shifting. We talked about Romney and how that's shifting. We talked in the Senate about how the negative ads seem to have affected the candidates. Also, the issue of competence. Who's seen as better on various issues, which, again, carries over between both the president and the Senate race. And finally, that issue of activation. Are voters really ready to run to the polls? So far, it looks like they are.
Charles Franklin, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin. He's visiting professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, co-founder of Pollster.com and Polls, and founder of PollsandVotes.com. We check in with him pretty often because he keeps coming out with these polls that tell us interesting things about the presidential race and the U.S. Senate race. Speaking of the Senate race, tonight at 7, the second U.S. Senate debate between Tammy Baldwin and Tommy Thompson. You can hear it live from Wausau here on the Ideas Network or online at WPR.org. You can watch it on Wisconsin Public Television. Go to WisconsinVote.org during the debate, by the way, and you can join in a live online chat following the important and superficial details all the while. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and Cynthia Schuster and Bill Martins for producing. I'm Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network.